Good morning. This is great. A full room. There are plenty of plenty. There are several chairs up in front. If any of you would like to come sit down, I know it's kind of hot and crowded in the back. Before I get started, I'd like to acknowledge some of my colleagues on this project. My mentor, Matt Seymour, who's also the PI on the Center of Excellence that Deep Thi just talked about. Are you here, Matt? I can't see in the audience with my glasses on. And then my research partner, Heidi Kramer, and my psychologist guru, Frank Drews. I'd also like to thank Juliana Grant, who was an EIS officer at the Utah Department of Health, and Jeff Norris, who also worked on the research project with us, who developed the scenario that I'm going to talk a lot about. Actually, do you just hit click, just click it, and it advances the slide? Okay. Actually, Deep Thi's presentation laid great framework for my presentation, because she talked a lot about the details, and you could see how complicated and complex and time-consuming the disease investigation process is. You can't live in the United States, I don't think, without knowing about infectious disease outbreaks that have occurred over the last couple years. Tomatoes, or was it jalapeno peppers? We had cantaloupe, we had cereal, chicken, hamburger, peanuts. We've had lots of problems with disease outbreaks, and it's a real significant problem, and if you didn't believe that, you probably wouldn't be here in the room today. Our research stepped back one step before Deep Thi's, and we were looking specifically at how these disease investigators make their decisions, their cognition. We looked at the ambiguity in the protocols that they used. We looked at the complexity of each case and the complexity of the fact that there are over 72 reportable diseases in Utah by law. There are, I don't know how many, 120, 150 on the CDC notifiable disease list. Anybody know the exact number off the top of your head? 77, thank you. So we actually interviewed some of the folks that Deep Thi talked about. We interviewed disease investigators in six local health departments in Utah, a local health department in Nevada, and people from the Utah State Health Department. And we were looking at people who made frontline decisions, like when that first report comes in, what happens? How do they make decisions? How do they use the protocols to be able to figure out what they're supposed to do, what data they're supposed to collect? And we found in many cases that the complexity creates cognitive overload. The ambiguity is difficult to navigate, especially when they're complex diseases or new diseases that they've never seen before, like mumps. Mumps is not a new disease, but many case investigators have never seen a case of mumps because it's just not that common anymore. And finally, we're interested in developing decision support tools to help investigators do a better job, more efficient job, more consistent job of doing these case investigations. So I talked about the interviews. I used 39 of the interviews for this particular analysis. The people we interviewed were epidemiologists. They were nurses, like Deep Thi talked about. And we also interviewed environmental health scientists who get involved with especially foodborne outbreaks. The interview took an hour and a half to 2.5 hour each, and we use a semi-structured protocol. The first half was open-ended questions, asking them about what kind of disease investigations they do and how they process them. The second part of the interview was a specific scenario, which I'm going to focus on today. The scenario looks at a cluster. I don't know if it's an outbreak yet or not. You'll have to tell me. And the interviews were all recorded. We transcribed them. We coded them. We also developed a database to actually record responses during the interview for the scenario. So we were able to compare the transcript to the quantitative data in the database. So although the basis for this research is qualitative, we also did quantitative and qualitative analysis of the data. So who did we have in our study? We had 29 women and 10 men, excuse me for doing those backwards. We had 8 rural, 31 urban, which is about the proportion in Utah. 80% of people in Utah live on the Wasatch Front, which is the urban area. I already said we had epidemiologists, nurses, environmental health scientists. And then we used, I guess you can't see my mouse. Can you? Oh, you can. We used the CSTE rankings for expertise. We had 12 novices, 8 that were intermediate, about 3 to 5 years, 15 people who supervised investigators, and 4 people who were considered senior scientists. That's just another view. This graph, that graph will kind of give you an idea of the proportion. For today's presentation, I want to particularly focus on the laboratory part of an investigation. Many of you have seen the textbooks where there's sort of standard steps for an outbreak investigation. And most cases, most confirmed cases of reportable diseases require a laboratory confirmation. So why should we care about laboratory tests? They help inform the outbreak investigation. The problem is lab tests are expensive, and sometimes they're invasive. It's hard for patients when duplicative tests have to be run. Sometimes doctors don't order them because they're expensive and people don't have health insurance. Sometimes only positive results are reported, and that can be a problem if you want to know how many cases a doctor's suspecting or if there's a false negative. So lab tests are not always definitive. Accuracy, reliability, sensitivity, and specificity of the tests actually matter, so the investigator can figure out how to use that laboratory report. And that information is rarely reported with the lab report. Generally, the results are positive, you know, positive for a specific disease. Does anybody know of an exception to that where the accuracy, the reliability, sensitivity, and specificity of a laboratory test comes with the lab report? And lab reports also aren't just ordered for diagnosis. There's other reasons why physicians might order a lab test, and a positive test that's reported to rule out someone being vulnerable to measles, like to test for measles immunity. If you had a positive to that, it might not necessarily be a positive measles case, just positive immunity. So disease investigators need to really understand what information they're getting on lab reports. Craig Kaplan, in his article, Use of Laboratories, says there's 5 things that investigators really need to know about lab tests. He's also talking about physicians. The probabilistic nature of diagnosis and its implications for ordering and interpreting laboratory tests. He says you need to know about reliability, accuracy, sensitivity, specificity, and the predictive value of the lab test. You need to know why the ordering physician ordered the test, what they're trying to find out. It's important to know what the normal range is for that lab test, and it helps to understand the strategy of a physician, why they're ordering the test or not, to know if it's, you know, what their normal ordering pattern might be could make a difference in what the results mean. So I'm going to make a transition now to the scenario and the results that we got from that. Can you kind of give me an indication of how much time I have left?
Yep.
So put your hat on and pretend you're in the interview. The interview starts out, you are the lead investigator in a small community and you just got a disease report phone message from a doctor in your community. The phone message says to you, I saw 5 unusual cases today. The cases were enteric diseases and they all had similar symptoms, nausea, diarrhea, vomiting. Okay, so this is going to give you sort of a big picture of the whole scenario. The scenario starts out on day 3 when the patients visit the doctor and the doctor makes the call to the local public health department. There were symptoms reported for another case later in the scenario. Lab tests come in. An inspection of a restaurant was conducted. PFGE matching was done. PFGE matching was done for another case. And then there's the ground truth. What really happened in this scenario is that the 4 adults reported eating at a common restaurant, not all together. They also ate at a potluck together. And then there was onset of symptoms for all the first 5 cases. There was than the doctor's visit, which we already went over the rest of this information. So this is what the phone message said. Today I saw five patients with GI illness. The symptoms included nausea, diarrhea, abdominal cramping. Two patients were husband and wife couple. Three were from another family. A young boy had bloody diarrhea. And all four adults mentioned eating at the same restaurant. So participants were then asked, what are you going to do? What do you want to know? So what we're trying to get at is their cognition. What's the underlying mental map that they use to make decisions about what data they're going to collect and how they're going to get that information? It was interesting to note that of the 39 interviews used in this analysis, only 26 noted that the doctor had prescribed Cipro for an enteric disease, which was reported on the first message. And there's a breakdown of between how those broke out. That's not really as important right now as the difference. If you understand enteric diseases, you know that there are certain kinds of enteric diseases that Cipro would make the disease worse, possibly could even cause HUS. Bloody diarrhea is a bad sign. So the first thing that happened was some people called back the physician, some people called other places, people wanted to confirm the information, some people immediately called the patients, but all 39 wanted lab results. So public health agencies that do these investigations rely heavily on lab results to trigger their investigations. If they actually did further investigation and called the patients, they would have found out information about what they ate at Bob's, when they ate at Bob's, what happened at Bob's. They could have learned information about the boys' preschool, whether other students were sick, whether other employees were sick. They could have found out information about a bed and breakfast where the couple worked, the couple ran a bed and breakfast, and they could have found out whether other people were sick associated with any of those places. Then, on day four, the lab results come back, and lo and behold, three cases are positive and two cases are negative. And most of the time, people expected the three positive cases to all be in the same family. And if we had to prompt them or explain to them, you know, look a little closer, it's not. Oh, it's one from one family and two from another family. And so then we asked them, why do you think some of those results would be negative? Why would they all have similar symptoms, but not all the lab tests were positive? So in most scenarios, these negative lab tests wouldn't have been reported if a lab is only reporting the positive cases. So if they did further investigation, they could have gone and done a restaurant inspection from Bob's. At Bob's, they could have found out if there were other sick employees. So should, this is a question, I don't know the answer. Should a food worker who was sick while working be tested? And if they test positive, should they be excluded from work? Some states have a law that says until you have two clear lab tests, you are not allowed to go back to work. In Nevada, they have health cards, and those are pulled from them, so they're not even allowed to legally work if the health department finds that they had a positive lab test. But, you know, if you can't work, if you're a food worker, you don't have an income. You don't have paid leave. Sometimes you don't have health insurance. Some people wanted to know, okay, so I'm jumping ahead to the potluck. It turns out that all four adults went to a potluck dinner at a man's house named Dave, and this is what they ate. Most of the participants expected the lasagna to have hamburger in it, and if it wasn't the hamburger that they ate at Bob's Burgers, they thought it might be the hamburger at the lasagna. Another clue was the spinach salad. Recently, people in Utah had investigated the spinach outbreak from Southern California, and that triggered an instinct, a heuristic. Oh, if it's this disease, it's probably going to be from spinach or hamburger. So we asked them, why do you think you got the lab results you got? There are lots of reasons why lab results might not be accurate, why you might get a false positive or a false negative, which could completely interfere with your investigation. Craig Kaplan, in this article, and I highly recommend it, talks about the kinds of things that are really important about laboratory tests and from a medical perspective, why we should care about them. Besides the fact that we spend a lot of money on them, they do have a significant impact on these investigations. So I'm going to wrap up and get to what my recommendations are. I believe we need to take two routes. We need to take the traditional training route. As you heard from Dr. Foldy this morning, there's a lot of turnover. There's a lot of needs in workforce development in public health. Lab tests change over time. People change over time. So training on lab tests, training on disease investigations needs to be ongoing. People need to be aware of what laboratory tests mean and how to understand them. And second, I recommend that we try to use decision support tools. We try to use informatics at its best to be able to help assist these investigators. So what are some examples of some of the things that we could do? Electronic medical reporting. Why can't the information that goes on that paper fax disease investigation form be automated? Why can't the information be pulled in from the medical record? It's all already there. We have a lot of work going on in community health information exchanges, and in the next decade, I hope we'll be able to see this actually happen. A lot of work's being done in electronic laboratory reporting, and we need to get more information from those lab reports, the sensitivity, the specificity. Why don't we have smart forms, those investigation forms that you saw Deepthi show? Why aren't those automated? Why don't they have decision support tools built in? Why don't they have definition of terms built in? Why don't they have explanations of what's wanted in the various places in the form? Why can't it be automatically filled out with the information that's already known by someone somewhere else? Also, why can't we have electronic automated line lists, the line lists that show all the cases in the investigation that can automatically have an algorithm to highlight the things that the people had in common, to highlight the high-risk areas and give some explanation about what that might mean? You're obviously not in the grid session that's down the hall. I would encourage you to learn more about the grid, but the grid's a possible way to have some centralized resources that's efficient to keep it current, and it's accessible to people by the internet all over the country. And that could include things like definition of terms. Case definitions for those 77 diseases, they change over time. State by state, what is actually reportable by law changes, and how they determine a case may change. So to be able to have easy, ready access to that kind of information could be really helpful. In addition, we heard that cases are different. Like if you're pregnant or if you're old, you heard about H1N1, the young and the people who already have other morbidity are more vulnerable. Algorithms could be set up to help people navigate for this specific case in this situation, you can do this or this. Outbreak simulators like Epinome, some of you may have participated in some of the studies on Epinome, can help provide training, can help people in a low-risk environment make decisions and through what-if scenarios. And finally, I think we should have something called Labopedia, that's kind of like Wikipedia, only has all this information about lab reports. I'd like to thank the Centers for Disease Control for our Center of Excellence grant, as Deepthi did. The department that I'm getting my PhD in, the National Library of Medicine and Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, who supported the first early years of my research. And my committee, Matt, Frank, I already talked about, Catherine Stay, Scott Naris, and Charlene Weir. Questions?
Time for maybe one or two.
You guys are going to let me get away without asking me one tough question.
Less than 11% of diseases communicable with people that are reported by
different definition as far as surveillance is concerned. So getting people educated in the difference and appreciating what the difference is really important in, you know, setting up a good public health. You know, we really put a lot of emphasis here.
Boy, that's a lot of stuff to respond to. Thank you for your comment. I think that's really important. First, I cut out about 30 slides to get into the details of lab reporting because I just didn't have time to cover all the details. Second, remember it was a scenario. It was hypothetical. We do have some physicians who sentinel physicians who pick up the phone and call, but we learned in our interviews that most public health investigators rely on the faxes or the electronic lab reports that come into their email box. So unfortunately, that is probably the case most places. I appreciated the question earlier about different kinds of reports that might come in for the same case, and I appreciate the difference in a diagnosis versus a surveillance definition. I think that just helps prove my point about cognitive overload and complexity of this. And why couldn't a computer help the investigator who maybe has only been in public health for a year? Why couldn't the computer help them say, if it's surveillance, it's this, but if it's diagnostic, it's this, and you need the clinical notes, plus you need the laboratory notes? I mean, computers can do things like that.
Yeah.
So paper really isn't that smart. Paper isn't really smart enough to help you make those kinds of distinctions. Second, a lot of the making electronic of these forms just is like an input form. It's all you do is type the information in the form and it goes into a database. Most of these forms still are not automated to the point where they give you lookup lists. What county are you in? You know, why can't that come in from the medical record? Pick lists for what the doctor is so that the information doesn't have to be retyped and be incorrect so that you can't match the lab report with the physician's report. The disease definitions, the case definitions, all those can be built into a computer system. They can't be built into a single piece of paper. Any other questions?
I think that we're going to have to cut it.
Thank you.